This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Human beings are competitive animals. For all our lip service to it's not whether you win or lose, we still love the unique honor of being the first. It's a memorable achievement for anyone, but for some, it holds an even bigger meaning. There's a long list of groups, interest groups, ethnic groups, racial groups, and others, for whom being the first symbolizes the fall of long-standing legal and cultural barriers. Today we're going to talk about the experience of being the first, not just to mark the accomplishment, but also to talk about the responsibility or perhaps the burden that can carry. There'll be plenty of time for your stories, too. What firsts have inspired you? What little-known first can you tell us about? And is there one in your family? Give us a phone call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Mary Frances Berry knows plenty about being the first. In 1976, she was appointed chancellor of the University of Colorado, where she was not only the first African-American woman in that position, but also the first woman to head a major research university. Mary Frances Berry currently heads the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights and joins us now from her office in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Well, thank you very much. And I'm also a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. I thought I'd put that in.
Okay, I will note that. What was it like to be the first female chancellor of a university at a time when I guess most of your peers were white males?
Well, it was, and all the people who reported to me as vice chancellors were white males, nice guys, very able. It was, some people regarded me as a curiosity. I remember the first day I arrived on the campus, all the media came from everywhere to watch me in my office for hours. when I would play tennis on the campus, people would come from all around to stand outside the fence to watch me miss all the balls. And when I would try to ski, which I didn't know how to do, they'd stand and watch me fall down the slopes. Not out of meanness, they just, you know, I was the new chancellor, and I was the first, and I was a curiosity. And so from that standpoint, it was sort of interesting.
Interesting is one way to put it.
And I think also that there were a lot of people who looked up to me because of it, just because I was first. To them, it was kind of a marker of, as you said in your opening, of change that had taken place in society that permitted all this to happen. And I would go to meetings. I remember one time, though, in town there, I went out to dinner with a friend who was passing through from out of town, and people came over and sat down at the table with us. We didn't invite them. Mm-hmm. They just pulled up a chair and said, "Hi, Chancellor. Gee, who's your friend, and what does it feel like being here, and do you like us?" And and I thought that that was quite amazing. But within the university community itself, which is quite a progressive community, seemed to be well accepted, and people seemed to be glad that I was there.
Yeah, I was wondering, I mean, do you think being first in an academic setting like you were is different from, say, sports or entertainment?
Absolutely, or being the first in some line of work, employment, like being a mechanic or some kind of engineer, or being someplace where the workforce is all male. There were already women faculty members there, of course, and mm-hmm. all already women students. Not many people, black people, because the population is very small, but some Latinos and some African-Americans. So there was much more diversity than you might find in some other line of work that someone would crack for the first time.
You were talking, I guess, a little indirectly in that first answer, though, about there's an awful lot of pressure on you.
Well, the pressure is that people from your own community or group that has been marginalized look to you and sort of, well, if you don't succeed, I wonder if anyone else will get this chance. And also, how you doing? How you doing? It's always sort of taking your temperature to see how you're doing. And I took a lot of risks that first year. There were things I thought that I needed to do, so I did them anyway. And I didn't spend much time thinking about, because you're first, what does this mean? I simply did what I had to do, and most of it turned out okay. Some of it didn't, but I felt that it was I did what I thought was principled.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And with us on the line is Lauren, who's in Pasadena, California.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm enjoying your show. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I was just going to comment on my findings as being a first. I am an African-American, 47. And I was the first of my parents' 9 offspring, the first and only, to attend college and a 4-year university and graduate. And I noticed a lot of resentment from my siblings, and it still exists to this day. I think because, you know, quite often I think in being a first, you have a different approach to life that's very unconventional, and people find that threatening and challenging. And even with employment that I've been able to land as a result of having a degree, quite often I was the first and the only African-American in a management position, and people that I managed were usually white Americans. There was a lot of resentment. So there's a lot of pressure, but I think it's necessary because that's the only way I can be, number one. And I think it's just necessary to exercise my freedom as a U.S. citizen to just go after whatever accomplishments that I personally think I want to gain. But it can be very, lonely, and you can be subjected to a lot of pressure. I often think of Jackie Robinson, and, you know, he died very young and had very bad health as a result of being the first. The pressures associated with being the first and how people treated him in society, I think, contributed to his bad health and his early death.
Well, there is one thing that resonated while you were talking. I remember one of the receptions. We used to have receptions on academic settings. You're always having receptions for one thing or another. And I remember people would come in who I guess were not quite attuned to things, and they would walk right past me to go over to talk to one of my vice chancellors, who they thought was the head of the university, because they could never imagine that somebody like me would be the head of a university, until someone told them, no, you just walked by the chancellor over there. I'm not the chancellor. But that happens to people in every walk of life, and it can happen to you. I know some members of Congress talk about that happening when they're with one of their aides, whether you're the first or the second, I think also, or the third or the fourth, and some of the stresses, either within one's family or otherwise, occur whether you're first, second, or third, although there may be some peculiar ones associated with being first.
Let me ask you both, while you're on the line, you were both African-American women and firsts in different ways. Was it more difficult from the African-American side or from the female side? Lauren, why don't you go first?
I almost want to say I found African-Americans overall to be supportive, and I find it very troubling, even in this day and time, to hear women across every socioeconomic spectrum to make comments about how they prefer to have a male manager because women can be, and then, you know, sometimes they use the B word, which really bothers me a lot. But I'd say as an African-American, I'd find overall African-Americans have been very supportive of me and other African-Americans who were attempting to just exercise their birthrights.
Mary Frances Berry, was your role different in terms of ethnicity or gender?
Oh, I think that, as Lauren said, African-Americans generally have been very supportive. And I think women who are not African-Americans has been a mixed sort of bag for the reason she gave. I was thinking, though, that in my own family, part of the attitude was more that they expected one of the boys or the males in the family to be first at something or other rather than I have a rather conservative family on these issues, rather than a woman. It took them a while to get used to the fact that the most accomplished in terms of public exposure and role person in their family, I'm talking about the extended family, was one of the girls. and not one of the boys. And then after they got used to it, it's been okay, but at first it was sort of strange.
Lauren, I wonder, you were the first in your family to go to college, and you said the only one of the kids to go. Were you the oldest?
No, I was the seventh of nine.
Uh-huh. So the one of the babies got the preferential treatment from the older one's point of view.
Well, yes, and to this day, I'm still being basically told that some of the comments that are made are kind of painful. One of my older siblings said to me, you were always different from the rest of us. And, you know, we had a very close family growing up. I was always quote-unquote different, but I think it was more that I was just academically inclined, and I grew up during the Civil Rights Movement, and it was televised. I was born in 1955, and so I grew up thinking that I was everybody's equal, and I also had a responsibility to attend college and do the very best that I could to advance the plight of African-American people and all people, and I still feel that way. And so even to this day, I'd say it's still pretty awkward being the person that I am because I don't fit into the stereotypical molds.
Well, I don't know if you plan to get to responsibility, but I want to put in a word about it just in case we don't. Having been first, in a way, it's there are burdens, but there are also benefits from my point of view, the modeling to other people, women, white women, Latino women, Asian American women, Native American women, and black women, in terms of the people that I've known in my career who have always said, you know, they were inspired by the kinds of things I've done, and being chancellor was one of them. And going to meetings and discussions with women at the higher education organizations who aspired to leadership and who weren't yet presidents or even deans, and who wanted to talk about, you know, how did they get there, what could happen with them, and then to look around me and see all of these women today who are presidents or chancellors, or there's so many of them I can't even name all of them there, and there are a few who are African-American and Latino, although not enough. But it's the inspiration for other people. Someone said to me once, I should have stayed at the University of Colorado since I was the first, and they were sorry that I left because I was first. And I said, well, as long as I live, I still will be first. I didn't need to stay there to do that. But it was a wonderful experience, and it also apparently has been an inspiration to people. There will come a time in our society when we don't have to make too much of people being first. I don't know if it'll come in my lifetime, because people who have been marginalized will in fact be seen naturally in every kind of occupation and profession and every walk of life. But we're not there yet, so I guess being first still has some significance.
Well, I'll end by saying you do serve as an inspiration to me still, and to others, and to my 19-year-old daughter. I thank you for being a friend.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you.
And Lauren, thank you for the phone call.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Mary Frances Berry, we appreciate your time as well. Thank you
all
so
right,
much for being with
thank
us.
Thank you. Bye.
Mary Frances Berry heads the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. She was with us by phone from her office here in Washington, D.C. We got this email from Eleanor Bell in Topeka, Kansas. At age 74, I still take great pride in the fact I was the first girl allowed to enroll in electricity and radio classes at North High School in Wichita. It's also worth noting that one of my classmates subsequently became the mother of Lynette Woodard, who was a trailblazer in women's basketball, first at North High, then at the University of Kansas, ultimately in the WNBA. So, what is your family story? What's the first that you did? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about what it's like to be the first in your family to reach an important milestone, the first in your community to make a notable accomplishment. We want to hear your stories. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our next guest has devoted part of her career to making note of African-American firsts. Joining us now is Jesse Carney Smith, university librarian at Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee, the author of Black First's 4,000 Groundbreaking and Pioneering Historical Events. She's with us by phone from her office. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much.
Well, why don't we start with recent history, very recent history. What are some of the firsts achieved by African Americans just this past year?
Okay. Before I answer that, let me say I wanted so much to interrupt your last conversation. I don't know whether I could have done it or not, but Mary Berry is a Nashvillian, and we are very proud of her, believe me.
We'll pass that along in case she's not listening. But anyway, go ahead.
There's some very exciting firsts that took place last year, and I'm sure we were all watching the Oscars, and when we saw Halle Berry win an Oscar for her lead role in Monsters Ball, she was the first black woman to win the award for lead role. And we have to, in doing this book, have to be very careful with the way an entry is worded, because she was not the first black to win an Oscar, but the first to win it in a lead role. At the same time, we saw Denzel Washington, and he won an Oscar. But this was the first for a black in almost four decades. Again, not the first.
Mm-hmm.
Sidney Poitier won earlier.
Lilies of the Field, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yes, yes. Then we those of us who sort of glued to television during some of those various shows that are on, such as Survivor, we watched the first occur right there earlier in 2002. There was a young lady whose name is Vesepia Towery, T-O-W-E-R-Y, who was the first black to win $1 million on that show, Survivor.
Uh-huh.
And so we found ourselves pulling for her, you know, to become the first, and she's a woman, too. That was an interesting one. We have, for those of us who watched the Olympics last year, we were very happy to see blacks win in bobsled. We watched the men won, the men won a bronze in the four-man race in February, and this was the first medal for a men's team in 46 years.
An American men's team,
yes.
Yeah.
But this is also the first time that black men in the United States had won medals in the Winter Olympics.
Of the 4,000 African-American firsts you've documented in your book, is there one that makes a particular impression on you?
Well, there are several. It's still at the Olympics. When I watched Vannetta Flowers win and become the first black there in that bobsled, I was so excited for her. You know, I don't even know her. I had not heard of her until that. To see somebody win in an area where few of us have been is very rewarding for me, and sure for others as well. That one, and then I watched the speed skater. Again, you don't see black speed skaters out there. And there was a black speed skater who won in that year, 2002, at the Olympics in Utah.
As you look to the future, do you see some important additions that you hope to make, or as Mary Frances Berry was saying at the end of our conversation there, that you look forward to the day when firsts aren't that important anymore?
I look forward to that day, but I'm going to agree with her. That won't be in my lifetime either. But I would be thrilled to see a black president of the United States, a black vice president of the United States. That may be a while. Even to have a woman, black or whatnot, to become president of the United States would probably take a while.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we were almost possibly able to see a black vice president if Colin Powell had decided to run, but he decided not to run on that ticket. But he did go on to become the first black Secretary of State, which is a wonderful thing also to witness. I think politics can and should do some wonderful things there. And if blacks do open up more in that area, they are so highly visible that it would mean so much to so many people.
The U.S. Senate.
Yes. And we've had blacks in the Senate, but I mean,
sure,
there were more there.
Yeah.
If we had a black Speaker of the House, you know, that would mean something. I'd like to see that day come. I'd like to see the day come when we have more black governors. You know, we've had only two. One was appointed governor in 1872, P.B.S. Pinchback in Louisiana, appointed to fill out an unexpired term of a white governor who was facing impeachment. But our first elected governor, black elected governor, didn't come until 1990.
Doug Wilder in Virginia.
That's right.
Yep.
That's right.
Well, Jesse Carney Smith, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Jesse Carney Smith books. Jesse Carney Smith's book, all those S's, is Black First, 4,000 Groundbreaking and Pioneering Historical Events, and she spoke with us from her office at Fisk University in Nashville. Now, joining us by phone from his office in Snowpack, New York City, is David Dent, the author of In Search of Black America, Discovering the African-American Dream. He teaches journalism at NYU, and appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me on.
In writing your book, you spent 5 years crisscrossing the country talking to African Americans about their lives and their aspirations. How important was this idea of breaking barriers?
Well, what's interesting about it is I think there's a diversity of opinions on the whole idea of African American first among African Americans. Sometimes it reflects generational divides. It reflects reflects the full diversity of the African American experience, something that I found in doing In Search of Black America. For example, I interviewed in Seattle a woman, Jacqueline Jones, who remembers the fact that her father, in growing up in the 50s in Cleveland, was the first African American car salesman at the dealership where he worked, and he got that job after pushing very vehemently for it. And he told his daughter afterwards, "You should never let anyone put a box around you and limit what it is you can be." And of course, that ethic stayed with Jacqueline Jones forever. She actually was one of the first women executives at Microsoft, and she's long since left that position. But I thought that was a very interesting perspective. But then in Detroit, Michigan, I interviewed a family that founded a school there, the Nataki Taliba School, as well as owns an art gallery, the G.R. Nanamdi Art Gallery. And according to that family, that family's ethos, that they try to downplay the whole issue of saying first, particularly as it relates to educating children, because there's an implication when you say the first that there's an implication of why. And what if you don't necessarily contextualize the why for younger people who've not grown up with a distance from the civil rights movement and a distance from some of the pain of African American history, there's a misunderstanding of why it is that we celebrate first, largely because of the heritage of racism and the issue of deprivation and the denied opportunities for African Americans to achieve.
Let me read you an email we got from Lori Pierce in Hawaii. I was the first black woman to hike the Appalachian Trail from Georgia to Maine in one season. Although this isn't as monumental an achievement as some of the others of your distinguished guests, I get some pleasure out of having done something strange and being the first black woman to do it.
And I think that's important for some people, and it's important for our culture because I think it also, in some ways, it speaks to strength against the odds. And I think that it will continue to be important, particularly for people 30 and over. But I think, as some of the guests also indicated, that the distance that we go from the civil rights movement, in fact, will lessen the importance of the first. And as African Americans journey into different arenas and walks of American life, the need to celebrate the first will not be as great. And of course, everyone, you know, looks forward to that day. You know, for the book, I interviewed many people who were the first. One person, Dan Blue, who was the first African American speaker of the North Carolina House, North Carolina General Assembly. You know, there were other people. There was a family of African-American cowboys and cowgirls in Illinois who ran a very successful rodeo production company and one of the first entrepreneurs in the state they were in to African-American entrepreneurs in the whole rodeo production world. And, you know, I think those are significant, and I think that we will continue to feel, as not just African-Americans, but Americans in general, because celebrate these firsts, because they actually are mean something for America in terms of America's growth beyond the ugly side of race relations prior to the Civil Rights Movement. So we can never forget that, and we, you know, so firsts will help us, will help to remind us of that past, but
at the same time,
we're looking forward to the day when we can get beyond celebrating firsts.
Sure. Let's get some more listeners involved. Our next caller is James, who's on the line with us from Indianapolis.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
And he segued right into what my thoughts were exactly. It's not so much that the person, I mean, although he did work for that distinction, it's more an indictment against the society that not allowed the ones that was below him to have attained that same position. I mean, it's not that there wasn't somebody that could have done that. It's just that he wasn't allowed the opportunity. I'm a 59-year-old black male. Me and another coworker, now this is not as upscale as some of the other things that I've heard, but the experience was no less extreme and stressful. We went into a situation where in 1966 or thereabouts, we went into the government mandated that this company that I worked for have more blacks in skilled trade type jobs. So I was put into, I was hired right off the street, and he was already working for the company, and we went into a printing area.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was a stressful situation.
Yeah, we were talking to Mary Frances Berry about her, the pressure on her. That's a lot of pressure on you, too.
That was a lot of pressure on, and, you know, and now I had to perform, but yet I wasn't getting the instruction because the setup was for you to fail. So it was, you know, it was something to do. You know, we had to work, and we had to just learn it pretty much on our own because we wasn't getting the instruction that we should have gotten. And I'm proud of the fact that I was able to do it for 30 years and retire from it.
David Dent, I wonder, we're using the word first. I mean, maybe pioneer ought to be a better word.
I think pioneer is. But I think what I take from the gentleman's call from Indianapolis is the fact that you know, the firsts are just so, there's such a diversity of African-American firsts, you know, from the skills trades to education to academia to the arts. I mean, of course, and we witnessed some of the most celebrated firsts this past year, you know, in Halle Berry, Denzel Washington, you know, and then Colin Powell, as Secretary of State. But I think that what I take from this call also is that we have to look just at the diversity of pioneers from various walks of life, and you know, and I think it's really a part of the opening of the American dream and the expansion of the American dream. So I think these firsts are something for all of America to celebrate too, as well as we all should also look forward to the time when these, when the celebration of such firsts are not as important.
James, thanks very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you for taking my call.
Wanted to read an email we got from Mary in Laner, Wyoming. Back in 1978, I was the first girl to take automotive mechanics in high school. I had to fight hard to get into the class as the guidance counselor insisted I take home economics instead. When I insisted on auto mechanics, he looked at me and said, "You get your hands dirty, you know." Well, I got into the class by refusing to take no for an answer. I was never accepted by the other male students. I got the most difficult jobs in the class. I didn't mind as I learned more. I was the only student to get an A in the class. Being first was very difficult, mostly because of the male students' resentment, but I was very proud to make the first steps to integrate the class. The following year, two girls took auto mechanics. That, an email from Wyoming. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now let's go back to the phones, and joining us is Jonathan, who's on the line from Boston.
Hello. My first is comparatively inconsequential, but my last name begins with A.
Okay.
And I've been going first since kindergarten. first grade, second grade. By the time I ended up being in the second or third grade, I began to say, hey, I'm seeing a pattern developing here. I'm always going first. What's going on here? I didn't understand. They're going alphabetically.
Yeah, C was still within, chalk range of the, mm-hmm. The teacher, yeah.
My sister married someone whose last name began with W, so she went from going first to going last. She says, I hated going first. She said, no, I'm going last. I hate that, too.
Were you rooting all the time for somebody named Aardvark to come into your class?
Yeah, when you know that you're going first, you have to be in some way slightly prepared, emotionally or psychologically. Exactly. Someone named Aardvark is not going to really be there to help you.
I think what you've just said in some way, in a lighthearted way, just underscores an important fact, and that is something we can't ignore, and that is the mental pressure of being a pioneer. And I think that's something that some of the earlier guests talked about, and I think that you just really can't underestimate the impact of that. Now, of course, particularly if you look at what was the impact of being a pioneer in pre-1965 America. It's much different today. But if you look back at being a pioneer in pre-civil rights, or even in the early days after many of the successful gains of the civil rights movement, I mean, there's an enormous emotional and mental toll on African Americans who were pioneers.
Anyone who knows that they're in some way different, that they're going to have in some way some special condition when they walk through the door, the pressure is just that pressure is just tremendous, and people do not really have a good understanding of what that is like for people.
David Dent, I wonder, in your book, obviously you talk to a lot of firsts, a lot of pressure on those people. Not all of them could have triumphed.
Well, I mean, that's very true. Not many of them triumphed, and not many firsts in other arenas of life. Other or first who are not African Americans, mm-hmm. were the first, whether in their family or the first in other way, the first in other ways, and that's true. It is, it's not necessary, just because you're the first does not necessarily mean you will be you will be successful at it. And there are, there are people I did interview who, I think of one person who worked at a radio station who was the first woman. And I'm trying to recall if she was the first African American too, but to become a disc jockey at this station, and she had a lot of difficulty there due to sexism, and she was not as successful in overcoming it as the caller from Wyoming, mm-hmm. was in overcoming the pressure she felt as being the first and actually finishing in the top of her classes, as was indicated actually in the email that you read. So I think that, yes, you're right, that many first do not succeed in the same way that a Colin Powell will, because there is a lot of mental pressure of being a pioneer.
Jonathan, I'm afraid we're going to have to let you go. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, sir.
And we're going to stay with David Dent and take a couple more of your calls. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about firsts. Our guest is David Dent, the author of In Search of Black America, Discovering the African American Dream. He's with us from New York City. I wanted to read an email we got from Lauren Sarno in Palo Alto, California. This is a small first, she writes, but it took more courage than I expected. In New Jersey, it gets cold in the winter. In 1969, girls were expected to wear skirts to school. I remember getting dressed for school in my warmest tight skirt and sweater, then putting pants on over my tights, which I had to remove before classes began. On the winter day in 1969 that girls were first allowed to wear pants, I did so. I was the only girl in school wearing pants. I was subjected to catcalls, ridicule, and behind-the-hand whispers from teachers about unfeminine girls. Of course, within a year, every girl wore pants whenever she wanted to, and the issue was no longer an issue. It's hard to believe it ever was an issue, but the first day was hard. Well, let's go next to the phones, and Brian joins us from Galesburg, Illinois.
Hi.
Hi.
I guess I have a couple of firsts. The first one's kind of shameful. I was the first one in my family to be incarcerated. And after that, I am now the first person graduating my university. I was incarcerated. I came out of my university, and now in that situation, I'm top of my class and was named top of my department.
That's a sort of roller coaster of firsts.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been kind of up and down on the firsts.
Yeah. How did you go from one to the other, Brian?
I was told when I went to jail, and my peer group is a very young man. I was just 18, heavy substance abuse. I was told that my peer group was like 98% recidivism, and I knew that I had to be the first in that group that walked out the door if I was going to survive. And so I worked hard to do everything I could. Walked into where I was, and for a long time felt that difference. You know, I'm not an African American, I'm a plain old white guy, but I know about that walking in the door and feeling different. The building that I'm in is the law enforcement building also. And so as I talk to those people and I talk to the guys studying to be law enforcement, they don't see the difference, but I feel it every day. And now all the people in my department know of my more notorious first and see past it.
But you didn't try to hide it?
No. No, when the issue came up, I've made it known.
Was there a day, though, maybe that first day when you went to school, you maybe thought you didn't belong there, this was going to be really hard?
Yeah, the first couple of weeks, just felt really out of place amongst my peers. I was, I lived in a dorm for my first semester, and it was scary to be around a bunch of 18-year-olds. I was 25. Their biggest concern was, you know, going out to the bar on the weekend, and my biggest concern is, when my parole officer shows up, are these people going to see his gun? Are they going to be scared of me?
That's a lot of pressure.
That is a lot of pressure. Brian, as David Dent just said, congratulations.
Thank you.
Appreciate the phone call.
You guys have a good day.
You too. Good luck to you. David Dent, does this matter less? You were talking earlier about the distance from the civil rights movement, certainly in the African-American context. In the personal context, like that caller, it's always going to matter. But in the African-American context, does it matter less to people who are younger?
I think it definitely matters less to people who are younger. I think that, you know, they've grown up, many of them, seeing, you know, African-Americans in a diversity of walks of life. So therefore, it's not as unique to them. So there's not the emotional connection to seeing a first. That there's some exceptions there, save the Oscars perhaps and some other more visible recent successes. But there's one other point that I think we have to point out is the fact that there is a concern that this came from some of the people that I interviewed across the country. There is a concern about the citing of first without a context, and that impact on people who have not, who are unaware of African American history, meaning young people, teenagers who may not have, who, you know, may not be fluent in understanding the African American condition pre-1968.
Yeah, who couldn't identify Jackie Robinson?
Exactly. I mean, for people, for young people, both black and white, there is, I guess, concern that the repetition of citing firsts without context, in some ways, without citing the context of why it's important that that these people are first and why it is something to celebrate, in some way may send a dangerous message, because it sends the message that that they are unique. Not because of the unique because of something to do with African American culture, which that's not the reason why they're unique. They're unique because of issues of deprivation and the lack of access to achievement and the heritage of that in this country. So it's really important that they understand that, you know, the reasons that we are celebrating first. It does not have anything to do with negatives in regard to African Americans.
Mm-hmm. David Dent, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
David Dent is the author of In Search of Black America, Discovering the African American Dream, and he was with us from his office at New York University in New York. One final email, this from Dean Cedar, that's in Pocatic, Connecticut. I don't know if this is the first that you had in mind, he wrote, but my great-grandfather was kidnapped and died from injuries suffered during the abduction. He was able to identify his kidnappers before he died, and they were the first to be executed under the Lindbergh Baby Law, which made kidnapping a capital offense. I don't know why, he concludes, but I love telling it.